Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. Nearly 20% of Americans don't have as much work as they need, or any work at all. But getting people hired takes more than a job summit and more than just passing a bill. Noel Cuellar is a small business owner, and he had this to say to the president last week.
Every month is looking better. It looks like, you know, we're bouncing back, but the ability to get the financing for the upswing, to buy the raw materials. So we're kind of struggling with buying raw materials or hiring people.
Capital is tight everywhere, but small businesses say they can't do their part for the economy without the cash, getting the banks to increase credit for a nation already well over its limit. Can businesses charge their way to a better job market? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 7th. I'm Celeste Headlee, and I'm here with Todd Zwillick for one more day. John Hockenberry is away again today caring for his new baby, Ajax Charles Hockenberry, but he will be back tomorrow.
Good morning, Celeste. 8 pounds, 11 ounces, Ajax Charles. We'll update you on the bank bailout that seems to be a winning deal for taxpayers. We'll have the news from the climate summit in Copenhagen, as well as an update on the healthcare debate. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
Violence has erupted this morning in Iran. In the past few minutes, the BBC is reporting police have fired live ammunition into a crowd of anti-government protesters at a university in Tehran. It's not known how many people have been injured. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC's John Lyne, who says the police have surrounded the university.
I'm getting some reports that it's getting really very violent out there, particularly as the students try and get out of the campuses and onto the main streets of Tehran.
Earlier, riot police fired tear gas, and used batons against the protesters who are trying to show their opposition to the Iranian government. Other protests are happening in other cities across the country there. Here at home, the government bailout program looks like it won't be as expensive as first thought. The Treasury says since most of the banks have paid off their debt, the hit to the deficit will be only $42 billion. That's instead of $431 billion that was projected. House Democrats want to use that money for a new jobs bill. But for many small businesses, the big problem is finding credit.
And for more on that problem, we're joined now by Dawn P. Jackson. She's owner of New Dawn Marketing Group and president of the group Women Business Owners of Prince George's County. That's in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. Dawn, last week at the Jobs Summit, the president said small business owners across the country like you have to have easier access to credit. How is your marketing business going? Can you get access to credit right now?
Very quickly, no.
What are the banks telling you when you try to get a credit line?
Well, I was told by a bank when I just sat down, we were going over some numbers, not to even bother applying you're going to be declined.
Not to bother applying at all, not even for a small credit line to expand your business.
That's right. I wasn't asking for enough money, and I'm too much of a credit risk for any more.
All right, Dawn, you're too much of a credit risk according to your bank. Well, your state of Maryland has some ideas to try to get easier credit to businesses like yours. So stay on the line because we want to talk to you and some officials from Maryland later on in the show.
The curtain has gone up on the climate change conference in Copenhagen. Delegates from nearly 200 countries will spend the next 2 weeks negotiating a treaty to combat global warming. Danish Prime Minister Lars Rasmussen, the host of the event, says there's only one goal.
Even though we can't solve all these legal questions in details in Copenhagen, we still need a binding agreement which can be implemented immediately.
But speaking this morning on The Takeaway, International Herald Tribune correspondent James Cantor says delegates do not expect a binding treaty out of this conference. Rather, it will set the framework for a possible deal next year. Futures are down today. The Dow is going to open at 10,388. The S&P will open up at 1,105. And the NASDAQ opens just a hair under 2,200.
Coming up, it is the season for giving, but how do you explain to your kids that the economy means you just can't give as much this year? We talk about your family life every Monday, and we'll talk more later this hour, but you can tell us your story.
This is Gretchen calling from Boston. I was in a discount retailer the other day and heard a parent tell their child that mommy's unemployment made their house invisible to Santa, so he probably wouldn't come visit them this year. That's how one parent explained the economy to their child.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us how this economy is affecting you and your children.
It hurts my heart. We're going to be talking more about climate change in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
I think the critical thing for us would be to free up the credit markets. I think it's critical. I mean, that is the one mantra that I constantly hear from large and small businesses across the board. Banks are just not lending money.
That's Ed Pawlowski. He's mayor of Allentown, Pennsylvania, where President Obama went last week for what was billed as a Main Street economic tour. Tomorrow, President Obama is set to offer a proposal that may include tax credits for businesses to create jobs. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry this morning. And in order to create jobs, small businesses need credit. We heard from Don P. Jackson a few moments ago. She's a small business owner in Maryland who shared her frustration that she and others around her can't get credit from their local bank to expand their businesses. Well, in Maryland, there may be some good news. Governor Martin O'Malley has a plan to help small business owners get credit. He'll announce it later on today. We're going to look at that state's plan with the Secretary of the Department of Business and Economic Development. He's Christian Johansson, and we'll have him in just a minute. But first, Don, I want to continue with you. Your bank said don't even bother applying for credit. Now, what was the reason for that?
Basically, I was too much of a risk. My business has not turned a profit in the last 3 years, and my response to that was, well, you kind of have to get the work in order to turn the profits. We've been losing work, but it didn't matter. I was told that even with the low amount I was asking for, it wasn't enough for them to even bother taking the risk because they wouldn't make any money on it.
What were you asking for? How much?
I was asking for $20,000.
$20,000. That's a true small business loan.
Right.
Well, if you haven't turned a profit in the last 3 years, you said, what would a $20,000 loan do for you? I mean, how is that going to get your business on its feet?
Well, this year has been probably our most challenging. With news of the economy going bad, I have a lot of my clients, which are all small businesses, kind of panic. And where marketing's concerned, it's the first line item cut. You know, and despite
and that's what you do. You have a marketing firm, so they're cutting.
Yes,
they're cutting you at the first.
Consulting firm. Right. So I lost a lot of clients this year. So what $20,000 would do for me? It's helped me literally shift gears. I'm independent right now, and that's because of what's been going on. I kind of felt it coming. Didn't want to even bring on an admin person, so I've been working more so from a business-to-business relationship, contracting and teaming, more so than taking the risk of expanding my business because I couldn't afford it.
Okay, so as the economy is shrinking and you're losing clients, you need that loan to help you expand your business to other markets so that you can stay afloat. I want to turn this around on Christian Johansson, who is Maryland Secretary of Business and Economic Development in Annapolis. Mr. Johansson, Don is down there in Prince George's County, not too far away from you. Tell us about Maryland's new plan, if you would, briefly, and we got to get into how this might help her keep her business afloat.
Sure, Todd. And what we're seeing nationwide is obviously a pullback to small businesses, and it's not so much anymore about having good credit, frankly. It's really an issue that even credit-worthy borrowers cannot get financing. And the challenge for most states is that no state can fill the lending gap, but it is possible to unlock in excess of $6 of bank lending for each dollar of state guarantee. And so we're creating a new program called the Maryland Small Business Credit Recovery Program. And specifically, what it would do is that it would guarantee small portions of small business loans to help banks expedite some of those loans and making those loans to small businesses.
So Don needs about $20,000. So at a cost of, what's 20 by 3? Just about 6, right? Close to 6, a little more than 6 grand on the taxpayers and loan guarantees, you can get her loan?
Well, what we do is to work with the bank lending process if they have their current underwriting process. And we have a program, we have two programs, one called a certified lender program. And that essentially would allow a bank to apply up to a $50,000 guarantee, not to exceed 50% of that loan, based solely on the bank's underwriting standard. And that's important because often what we've seen with SBA loans is that they've taken quite some time because you have to use the SBA guidelines.
SBA is the Small Business Administration.
Exactly. Right. In our case, the bank would be able to use their existing underwriting underwriting standards, and they could apply up to a $50,000 guarantee on that loan. So in Don's case, you could apply a $10,000 guarantee on a $20,000 loan because it's up to 50% of a loan.
Christian, just a quick question. Didn't we see this exact kind of governmental advocacy, say, 10, 15 years ago, trying to get homeowners into their first house? And didn't that cause a problem when the government interferes in the lending process for banks?
Well, in this case, what we're seeing are actually what we would term creditworthy borrowers that have had a track record long-term of building successful businesses, and they're not getting loans. And what we are proposing to do is to work with a limited number of banks here in Maryland that we know have a strong credit process, and specifically ask the question, do you have creditworthy borrowers that may be just a little bit shy on the collateral? Because that's the biggest issue. The bank is trying to have collateral for every dollar of that it's extending in credit. And can this guarantee help to push that loan out the door?
Well, that's part of the question we have to answer. Christian Johansson, Maryland Secretary of Business and Economic Development. Well, Don P. Jackson in Prince George's County, small business owner, are you encouraged now that the governor is going to introduce this plan on Monday morning? Are you ready to head back into your bank on Tuesday morning and ask for that loan?
I'll be the first one there. And what I truly hope for this, I hope that it will be just the jolt that a lot of our small businesses need. You know, there are several women in my organization who are not only experiencing what I'm going through, but also, you know, should they be closing their businesses? So it's really a crisis, and I hope that the access to funding is actually there and that this comes to fruition for us.
Don P. Jackson is in Prince George's County, and she needs a $20,000 loan to start hiring. There are millions of small business owners just like her across the country. Maryland is trying to do something about it. Christian Johansson is Maryland's Secretary of the Department of Business and Economic Development, bringing us up to speed on a new program of loan guarantees in Maryland, hoping to help Ms. Jackson hire just like we need across the country. Thank you both for joining us. And now here's a look at the headlines we're following at 14 minutes past the hour.
Our partner, the BBC, is reporting that riot police in Iran have used live ammunition on the streets of the capital. Hundreds of police are surrounding the main university to stop students using the annual Students' Day rally to vent their opposition to the government. Protests have also broken out in other parts of Iran as well. Staying overseas, the Global Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen has opened. Delegates from 192 countries attended the opening ceremony, which included a video featuring Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Here's a little sound from that video.
All scientific prognoses show that the continent of Africa will be severely hit if we do not act now.
The talks will continue for 2 weeks. New pledges on emission cuts by the United States, India, and China have raised hopes that delegates at the summit will be able to reach some kind of deal. Back in the U.S., President Obama is hoping to get more help in Afghanistan from Turkey when he meets this morning with the country's prime minister. Turkey's the only Muslim country supporting NATO in Afghanistan.
Following a rare Sunday session, lawmakers are back to work today debating the health reform bill. On the Senate's agenda today, discussion on funding abortions in government-subsidized health programs. Today is the 68th anniversary of the attack by Japan on Pearl Harbor. A ceremony will be held at Pearl Harbor today in Hawaii to mark the anniversary. And there's a day of national mourning in Russia today. It's to commemorate the deaths of 112 people in a nightclub fire this past weekend. Coming up, we'll talk about the Episcopalian Diocese of L.A. and their election of an openly gay woman as bishop. It's the second gay person ever to have been elected, and it's threatening yet another schism in the Anglican Church. More on that in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
That's right. We got your news takeouts this morning, and with us is Louise Story, our finance reporter from our partner, the New York Times, and Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Louise, okay, this is kind of big news, right? It turns out that the TARP bailout for Wall Street will be almost entirely paid back. The only thing they're thinking will be left out will be about $42 billion.
So this is what the Treasury Department is telling us, and they plan to broadcast this today. It was in the New York Times this morning. that instead of losing $341 billion, which is what they estimated in August they would lose,
right,
they think now they might just lose around $42 billion. So it's about $200 billion better than what they thought.
Which is actually pretty darn good.
It, you know, it's all a matter of perspective. Of course, you know, if you're running an investment fund and you only lose $42 billion,
right,
that's pretty bad. But then again, if you thought all $700 billion of the bailout was going to be gone, then this is a lot better. So it's all kind of dependent on what you thought.
In terms of the budget, that kind of gives Congress $200 billion to play with, or no?
Well, that is the big question. So there's a number of Democrats in the House who are talking about using some of this paid back TARP money, the money that's come back from the banks, for something else, like job creation. You know, another thing one of my colleagues, Gretchen Morgenson, wrote yesterday about is the program really just focuses on the first lien debt. You know, a lot of people have two loans. And the reason it didn't focus on the second lien debt, she points out as a possibility, is because the banks, which are the servicers, own the second lien debt. And they don't want to take this hit. You know, it could be $440 billion of this stuff that they don't want to write down.
Right.
And so there is a problem that there might be a conflict of interest in these servicers who are making the modifications,
right,
that they don't want to modify what they hold.
So maybe with this extra $200 billion, the Congress
can force
them to move. We'll see. Thanks. Okay, that's Louise Story of the New York Times.
And we're still a long ways away from taxpayers getting any checks of profit away from TARP.
I think so.
All right, now it's time for our first religion takeout in the takeout section. We have Kevin Ekstrom, editor for the Religious News Service. Kevin, the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles had a landmark vote in the Anglican Church over the weekend, electing an openly gay woman as bishop. Is this vote going to be as controversial as the first time a gay bishop was chosen in New Hampshire, I think back in 2003?
It very likely could be, in part because what the Episcopal Church has done is basically defy the will of the larger Anglican communion headed by the Church of England, who have asked the American Church not to do this, and they've been very clear about that. And at first the U.S. Church said, okay, fine, we won't. This summer they said, actually, we might. And this weekend they actually did.
They did. Now, we're talking about Mary Glasspool. She's been elected the second gay bishop in the Anglican Church and the first woman bishop, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so a gay woman and a woman. I guess that's two firsts there.
Which is the most controversial part.
It's hard to know which is the most controversial part. Well, they, you know, the conservative wing of the Anglican Church, Kevin, was talking about a schism back when a gay bishop was elected in New Hampshire. So does this make it even more likely now, or is this more angry talk?
It's probably more likely. But the thing is that most of the people who were really upset about the gay bishop in 2003 have already left. So what you're left with now is a much more liberal church. The people who are going to be really upset about this, by and large, aren't here anymore. But there are still very angry people overseas in sister Anglican churches.
And mostly across the United States in the Episcopal Church there, people are more or less fine with it?
Well, I wouldn't say they're more or less fine with it, but they're they've got a much more liberal church now than you did 6 years ago. And this past summer when they met in Anaheim, they sent very clear messages by very strong majorities that they were going to be okay with this if it should happen.
Okay, well, somewhat of a schism already in place in the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles electing its first gay woman bishop, Mary Glasspool. Kevin Ekstrom from Religious News Service, thanks for joining us.
Okay, now time for sports. And Ibrahim, we have still two teams with perfect records, the Indiana Colts and the New Orleans Saints. Kept it alive this weekend, though. It was a tough going for the Saints.
Breeze throws. It's up for grabs. It's an interception. And then it's taken away by Robert Meacham. Meacham goes in for a touchdown.
What a crazy game, right, Ibrahim?
It was crazy. The Redskins lost 33-30 in overtime. And that's why I'll say the Redskins lost the game. And they had a chance to dethrone the undefeated New Orleans Saints.
Most respectable result they've had all season. The Redskins, I have to say, even though
they lost. True, even though they lost. The thing about this time in the season and what you're seeing is that the teams that, you know, early in the season, we talked about teams that were so far apart. Now
right.
You're seeing teams that have had much more difficult season in the beginning starting to play tougher. People getting into that playoff vibe, that playoff energy. And so that's when you start getting to the playoff picture. So the Saints win, and they're looking to run the table in NFC, because yesterday also Minnesota lost 30-17 to the Arizona Cardinals. Now, what that basically sets them up for is that Now the Saints are in a position to have home field advantage throughout the playoffs in the NFC.
Well, will the Colts start benching some of their better players, possibly they lead up to the playoffs?
And that also, because the closest to them is the Bengals at 9 and the Chargers at 9-3. Both of those teams are 9-3. So they can start benching some of their players. And they've said in the past that having an undefeated record is not a big deal for them.
Okay, that's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway sports contributor. Thanks so much.
Now, our last takeout comes from you, the listeners. Last week, the economy got some good signs with a better-than-expected unemployment result. But that's what economists were watching. What are you seeing in your neck of the woods? That's what we wanted to watch. And, you know, the economy is so complex, it's got me a little bit confused this morning. Larry in Detroit is going to straighten me out. He emailed us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. My shop is located along a major east-west rail line. I've noticed a real upswing in rail traffic recently, with many of the trains pulling fully loaded rail cars full of new cars. It's an unscientific piece of evidence that things are really picking up, I know, but nonetheless, one I think still shows some hope.
We're always looking for your views and your takes, and we're looking for you to be our reporters on the street, always. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number to call, and you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll talk about those protests in Iran. Coming up, we're getting word from our partner, the BBC, that Iranian security forces have fired live ammunition in the direction of anti-government demonstrators in Tehran. Hundreds of police have surrounded a university as protesters gathered to show their opposition to the government. We'll have a live report in just a moment. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. In Denmark, delegates from almost 200 nations are now gathered in Copenhagen for the UN Climate Conference. The Danish climate minister describes what would make the conference successful.
A politically binding deal where you set sort of clear targets with regards to emissions, but where there's also obviously funds for the developing world.
But speaking last hour on The Takeaway, International Herald Tribune correspondent James Cantor says many delegates do not expect a binding treaty out of this conference.
Here at home, the Virginia couple who crashed President Obama's state dinner recently aren't the only ones to breach presidential security. A report compiled by the Secret Service shows that security surrounding the president has been breached 91 times in the last 30 years. The Washington Post says that includes a family who was mistakenly allowed onto the White House driveway in a minivan, and a man who joined Harrison Ford's entourage to get close to President Clinton. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says any troop pullout from Afghanistan will be slow, and Americans should plan on being in the region for a long time. Despite some criticism, Gates told Meet the Press, the announcement of the withdrawal date had many purposes.
I believe that there is an important element here of balancing sending a signal of resolve, but also giving the Afghan government a sense of urgency.
Gates went on to say that the 2011 withdrawal date is just the beginning and not the end of a pullout. Stocks ended mixed in Asia with the Nikkei up, but the Hang Seng index down. European markets are lower in early trading. Gold is also slumping this morning. Futures are a bit down. The Dow opens at 10,388. The S&P opens at 1,105. And the NASDAQ opens just under 2,200. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Very disturbing reports coming out of Iran right now. Today is Students' Day in that country, and what that means is that it's an annual commemoration of the killing of three students in 1953, but the story is unfolding in Tehran. Student protesters have gathered there to express their opposition to the government, and our partner, the BBC, is reporting that riot police have fired live ammunition in addition to using tear gas and batons against the anti-government protesters. We're joined now by Hamid Dabashi. He's the professor of Iranian Studies and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Celeste.
I have to ask you first, are you surprised by these reports coming out now that the police may have fired live ammunition into the crowds?
I'm a bit surprised because all the indications were up until yesterday that the security apparatus will act in a way that it will not get that to that level. But apparently things have gone out of control. The report of BBC has not been verified elsewhere. I mean, I have no way of either questioning its validity or verifying it. I've been following wild, a direct line that is coming out of Iran, and this situation is quite chaotic. And the news of live ammunition were around 7 o'clock in the morning, our time, New York time. So it is too early to verify any of this.
Remind us again what the students are protesting about. Iran has been in the news a lot lately, but they've been in the news in their disputes with the United Nations over their nuclear facilities. But that's not what the students are protesting about.
Oh, not really. This particular demonstration is in the aftermath of the June presidential election, that there is widespread assumption of fraud. The millions of Iranians don't recognize Ahmadinejad as their president. There is a strong civil rights movement that is taking momentum and finding newer and newer dimensions. Mr. Mousavi yesterday issued a statement, the presidential candidate who many believe was robbed of his election, that suppose that you control people on the 7th of December, what would you do on the 8th of December? So this is yet another twist in the unfolding drama of a student, in fact, leading. It is very important for Americans to keep in mind that this is very much reminiscent of 1968 in my own alma mater, Columbia University, uprising. This is not just for university student causes. This is civil rights movement, very much in the condition of the anti-war and civil rights movement of the 1960s in the United States. So the history of it, as you said in the introduction, goes back to 1953 in the aftermath of the CIA MI6 engineered coup that toppled Prime Minister Mossadegh and brought Shah back. And in fact, the occasion for that particular incident on 7th of December 1953 was then Vice President Nixon going to Iran to support the newly installed Shah. Three university students were shot dead,
okay.
And that day since 1953 has been considered a very important day for the students. But in the most recent demonstration, these are all new dimensions of the civil rights uprising that evidently the Islamic Republic is incapable of controlling.
And as you say, they seem incapable of controlling. They have tightened down on security, though. In recent days, they've arrested more than 20 mothers who were mourning kids who were killed in the unrest that broke out since the disputed June 12th elections that you talked about earlier. Is the government, this government that has taken a hard stance internationally and would seem to need a stable environment at home, can they tamp down this opposition?
If you, Celeste, consider the unfolding events since June, we are now early December, all the indications are that, in fact, the proportions of demonstrations are being exacerbated. In fact, today, as of last night, pictures of Khamenei, the leader, and Ahmadinejad, and even pictures of the founder of the Islamic Republic, Khomeini, I have seen them in videos that are coming out of Tehran, burned. Death to dictator, death to Khamenei, etc., are heard not only in Tehran, but also in Mashhad, the other city in northeastern Iran, in Shiraz, in central Iran. So, no, the answer to your question is that this particular unfolding of events seems to be assuming newer dimensions beyond the control of the Islamic Republic security apparatus, which, as of now, it has turned itself into a security machine. It just acts like a porcupine. All its sticks are out.
Hamid Tabashi at Columbia University, I want to ask you, we got some reports earlier this morning that the Iranian government had tried to slow down the speed of the internet, apparently to discourage use of YouTube and Twitter and Facebook and social networking that was so important a few months ago when Mousavi and his supporters had taken to the streets, so important to them in getting support in the West. Do you have any confirmation that that is the case? And what is the internet traffic like from the students themselves right now?
That, Todd, has been correct since, in fact, 48 hours before today. But they are not successful. Things are coming out. Alternate routes are created. Things are being sent to the Gulf area, the Persian Gulf area, and to Europe. And through Europe, it finds its way around the globe. So, yes, the crackdown, the control of the foreign media is all underway. But the feed is absolutely constant. It is the minute-by-minute blogging is happening from inside the universities, and there is no way to control them. The news is coming out almost minute by minute.
And Hami Debashi, one of the reasons that we cannot completely confirm the fact that Iranian police have fired live ammunition is because, as you said, they've sent journalists out of the country. We spoke with a BBC journalist from Turkey because that is as close as he could get to Iran. And I'm sure we'll be getting, however, more confirmations later today. Hami Debashi is a professor of Iranian studies and comparative literature at Columbia University. And we're going to talk more with the BBC's John Line more about Iran later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, who's at home with his newborn baby son, Ajax Charles, 8 pounds, 11 ounces.
That's a big baby.
It's a big baby. Well, in Washington, President Obama made a rare Sunday appearance on Capitol Hill to urge Senate Democrats to finish the job of shaping the health care bill, which remains on the Senate floor and probably will until Christmas at least. In order to get a final vote, though, the bill's going to need the backing of 60 senators. So that's either unanimous support from all 60 Democrats and independents in the Democratic caucus, or some help from a Republican or two. So far, the bill is getting no support from any senators on the right-hand side of the aisle. So this debate has been about money and about policy, but it's also about ideology.
Thanks to Senator Harry Reid's leadership, we're down to two major issues, abortion and public option. And I think we're coming to closure on those issues. We're likely to come to a vote on the abortion question maybe by tomorrow.
Well, Democratic Whip Dick Durbin there thinks that they're coming to closure on the public option and on abortion. David Herzenhorn is congressional correspondent for our partners, the New York Times. He's been hanging around the Senate. David, is the Democratic Whip correct? Are they coming to closure on abortion and the public option?
Good morning, Todd. They seem to be headed to a vote today on abortion, or at least a big debate on the Senate floor, which, of course, is one of two major issues that there's still a lot of disagreement about, the other being the public plan, the so-called public option or government-run insurance plan.
Now, what are they going to do on abortion? What is the substance of the debate they're going to have here?
Well, the House-passed bill includes some very tight restrictions on abortion insurance coverage for abortions. Basically, any insurance plan that's paid for even in part by federal subsidies would not be able to cover abortion. And there are obviously pro-choice senators who are very uncomfortable with what they see as a greater restriction on abortion than exists currently in federal law. What we'll see in the Senate is Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska seeking to add the tighter House language to the Senate bill and then pushback from more liberal Democrats who will look to keep the language that the Senate Finance Committee had in there originally, which basically says no federal money could be used for abortions, but the plans could potentially cover abortion if they segregate out private paid premiums to
right.
pay for those.
Which is sort of existing federal law now. Well, David, a couple of weeks ago, the liberal Democrats that you described were pretty happy with the more permissive abortion language, and they were happy because they didn't think that there were 60 pro-life senators to do what Nelson wants to do. Are they right? Is this going to pass?
There don't appear to be enough votes for Senator Nelson to add that tighter language to the bill. But as you know, this is a seesaw. It's hard to get 60 votes for either way. So
for anything.
To change the language that's in there will be tough as well.
Now, Nelson is also a linchpin in the debate over the public option quickly. He wants to change that as well. Are there 60 votes developing early in the week here for any change to public option that will help bring these Democrats like Nelson along to pass this bill eventually?
The Democrats are really trying to hammer that out behind closed doors at this point. Right now, there is no agreement. They're focusing on an interesting new idea that would model a plan on the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, which covers more than 8 million federal workers, including members of Congress. There's some political appeal in telling people you have something similar to what members of Congress get.
Exactly, and what the president gets himself. If it's good enough for them, it's good enough for you. That's kind of the political selling point. David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, bringing us up to speed on abortion and the public option raging this week in the health debate. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Todd Zwillick. John is with us for one more day before John Hockenberry comes out. He was out for a good reason. 8 pounds and 11 ounces of good reason. Little Ajax Charles Hockenberry, born last Friday. John will be back tomorrow. Speaking of families, we talk about them every Monday. And when the economy gets bad, a lot of families have to cut back over the holidays. Many parents are having the conversation with their kids now about how much or how little Santa is going to bring or how many presents they're going to get over Hanukkah. That conversation is coming up in just a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Federal officials are saying that the H1N1 or swine flu vaccine shortage is easing up. Another 10 million doses are expected this week. That message is being delivered in a new series of TV and radio ads being released today. 2 weeks of talks aim at agreeing on a new deal on climate change have begun in Copenhagen. At the opening ceremony, the Danish Prime Minister said an agreement was within reach and the entire world is looking to the summit to safeguard humanity.
The American envoy to North Korea, Stephen Bosworth, has been consulting the South Korean government before he travels to the North for 3 days of talks. His visit to North Korea will begin on Tuesday. As we've been reporting this morning, thousands of opposition protesters have clashed with Iranian security forces in Tehran. There are even some reports of live ammunition being fired. The BBC's James Cantor is joining us now. Mr. Cantor, James?
Yes, hello.
Hello, hi. Oh, James, you're in Copenhagen?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. I was just reading about Iran. James, you're at the Copenhagen Climate Conference. I can hear some activity behind you. You're in the hall where the meeting is going on. What's gone on so far?
Well, what we're seeing here today are the opening addresses from the various leaders of the nation. So, as you had at the top of the report, we have Spain presenting the event. We have the United Nations officials. At the moment, what you're hearing in the background is Jonathan Pershing, who is heading up the U.S. negotiating team at the moment, speaking at a live press conference.
A live press conference. Now, James, expectations of this conference have been tamped down, and people have been saying they hope to come out of this with a framework. When people say in politics they want a framework, that usually means they're not expecting much. What do you think is going to be the result, ultimately, of this conference of 192 nations?
I think the result could be this framework if the amazingly complex jigsaw puzzle of getting 192 nations to back that framework happens. That won't be a global treaty. That may happen sometime next year. But just even reaching that framework accord will be an historic moment if it is indeed reached in a couple weeks' time.
Okay, James Cantor is at the Climate Conference in Copenhagen. James, thanks for joining us. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually there we are and what we are is still family.
Lots of families are having to cut back on their holiday spending, and so is my family. I broke the news to my son, Grant. You know it's going to be a tough Christmas this year, right?
Right.
We're going to have to go kind of low on the spending?
Right.
Well, you get to pick one present this year. What is it going to be?
A big, expensive robotic action set.
The Rockenbach, the German monorail system, you mean?
Yes.
Big, expensive. You know that's, you know, going to be not quite as expensive as we usually spend on you, right?
Yeah, I know, but it's big and expensive and it's cool.
Okay. Also, Marvin Powell had the same kind of conversation with his family as well, from what we understand. He was laid off from General Motors in October, and he joins us from Southfield. Good morning, Marvin.
Good morning.
You had a similar conversation with your kids?
Well, you know, we've always sort of low-key the gift-giving thing at Christmas time as far as, like, Santa Claus and stuff is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And my son, you know, we were my wife has a daycare here. And we had a few latchkey kids here, and they were watching TV and saying what they wanted for Christmas. And my son just blurts out, you know, Christmas is not about gifts.
You know, which I'm sure they took very well.
Right, yeah. Well, they're older than him, so. But he said, you know, Christmas is not about gifts. It's about God's son and us being thankful. So and that's always the message that we've always endeavored to teach him. And, you know, we try to get one pretty nice gift And then the rest are things that he might need or, you know.
Please don't tell me you get them socks. That's Marvin.
Oh, absolutely not.
Marvin Powell is talking about the conversation he has with his two kids. We're joined by Yolanda Galt-Cavanis. She's a longtime parenting journalist. Yolanda, is it, if you're going to have a lean Christmas or Hanukkah or however you celebrate the holidays, is it important to have this conversation with your kids?
It's important to have a conversation with your kids when you're going to have a lean anything or change in what they usually expect. And I think that, you know, you're lucky, you're a step ahead if your son doesn't really expect that, but that's not the case for a lot of kids, and you want to level with them because kids have huge, huge, huge anxiety detectors. You're not going to fool them. You don't want to. They will know that something's up, and you need to just level with them.
I think all of us want to think that our kids are like Marvin Powell's and that they think Christmas is not about the gifts, but, you know, honestly, that's not exactly true. What do you do when your kid throws a tantrum?
Ooh, hard. You know, that's why you tell them, though, ahead of time. And you know, explain it, though, in a pitch positive way. I say, you know, let them know that this is a temporary thing. You're going to bounce back from it and replace what you're usually going to be giving and things with experiences, because kids really do want your time. So if you can quick shot, you know, not say, oh, you're not going to get the Rock'em Sock'em Robot, but you're going to take a walk in the park with me. You don't want to do that, but just start ramping up the time you're spending with them, ramping up the kind of experiences you're having with them. And that will really mean a lot. You know, when you have a job, you have the luxury of spending money, but you don't have the luxury of spending time. So this is the time where you can do that. You can create new traditions. You know, you can do stuff that you wouldn't normally have time to do with them.
Marvin, let me ask you. I mean, it sounds like your son is pretty okay with having a leaner Christmas, and you told us that you've had this conversation with him. But how do you feel about it? Do you feel kind of disappointed that you're not able to fill the stocking?
I mean, yeah, as a parent, as a dad who really loves his kids, you want to be able to give them everything that they want. You know, you want to be able to do that. But one of the things that we did early on, and a lot of people will probably be upset about this, but my son loves the movie The Polar Express.
Uh-huh.
And we taught him when he started watching it that Santa Claus was exactly what that movie was, that Santa Claus is fun and that he's great to think about, but he's like the cartoon. You know, you turn the TV off and he's not really there, you know.
Right.
And so that kind of softens the blow when you even level with them. I think about who Santa Claus really is. So,
right.
And not to say that, you know, we did have an incident where my mother kept saying to my son that she thought he was getting a train for Christmas.
Right.
And when
he didn't
see the train, he did throw the tantrum because it was told to him that he would be getting it. But so this year, that's the strategy to kind of like not suggest what he might be getting. And then anything that he gets, you know, and I have some ideas about some things that are less expensive but still fun.
Okay, Yolanda, one last question for you. You know, many people, I think, are maybe surprised when they find out how much of their kids' ideas about the holidays are wrapped up in presents. I mean, maybe surprised at the reaction. Is there a way to kind of move them away? Is there a way to maybe get kids thinking about it a different way, maybe get involved in charities or volunteer work over the holidays?
It really is. And when you explain to them what the finances are in your family and you level with them and you tell them what the proactive things are you all can do as a family to make things better, you'd be amazed. I'm not unemployed, but I'm underemployed. So I've had similar conversations with my kids, and I've got three of them. And I have to say to them, look, this is the way the situation is. This is what we can do, but we got to cut back. And what are some of your ideas? And they really get off on, well, we don't have to have pizza out. We could make it. You know, and so they really want to get involved, help other people, and it gives them perspective on what's going on in their family.
Okay, that's Yolanda Galt-Cavanis. She's a longtime parenting journalist, and we heard from Marvin Powell, who was laid off from General Motors in October. Thanks to both of you. What's your strategy in telling your kids that Santa will be a little slimmer this year, or the stocking will be a little less full? Or do you think kids should never expect to get every present on their list?
John, Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We have six children. Our children called up last night. How many Christmas presents on our list this year? 10? No, we said 5 each. They said 10. We said no, 5 each. They went, okay, 5 each. Good night. We all love you.
Good morning, Philomena from Westchester. My unscientific take on the economy is being in the American Girl store the other day in the city, you would not believe there was any form of a recession given the amount of people there and the amount of the purchases. I probably made the smallest purchase in the store.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Hadley. John will be back tomorrow to tell us all about his new baby, Ajax. This is The Takeaway. Thousands of activists join world leaders in Copenhagen today with a simple message.
Never turn your back on Mother Earth.
This isn't about holding hands and planting trees. There'll be fierce arguments over caps and carbon emissions and funding for poor countries in their fight against global warming.
Even though we can't solve all these legal questions in details in Copenhagen, we still need a binding agreement which can be implemented immediately. That's a success. A failure is something opposite.
The last big polluter, India, has joined China and the U.S. with a pledge to reduce greenhouse gases. Will this be the year we sign a deal on the environment? We're not turning our backs on Mother Earth on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillik, filling in for five-time dad, John Hockenberry.
Yeah, he's a five-time dad as of Friday. That's our breaking news from over the weekend. Good morning, Todd. We're going to have the latest news on the healthcare debate in the Senate. It's going to get heated there today. Also, details about how President Obama crafted his new Afghanistan strategy. Right now, Iranian security forces are clashing with thousands of protesters outside Tehran University. There are reports of the police using live ammunition, as well as pro-government militiamen wading into the crowds, beating men and women with batons while the security forces fire tear gas. The police surrounded the university as protesters gathered to show their opposition to the government. And as we've been talking about, the largest and most important climate change conference in many years is now underway in Copenhagen. 192 nations will try to reach an agreement to reduce greenhouse gases and slow global warming. We're going to go to Copenhagen now to speak with James Cantor. He's the correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, and he's been covering the story for us all morning long. Good morning, James. How's the weather there? Any smog lingering over the climate conference?
No. It's actually extremely overcast here and a little bit chilly. Danish officials have been boasting about how clean their harbor is and how you can even swim in it, but even they've been warning that it's a little chilly for that this time of year.
It's too cold to swim in it. When people meet up in Copenhagen, we've heard a lot about what's on the agenda, but what's the first thing people ask each other?
They're probably saying to each other, how much progress can we make in the next 2 weeks so we can get some holiday next year? They really have been meeting nonstop for the last couple of years, and I think they want to get some time off at some point next year.
That's James Cantor, correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, joining us from Copenhagen. We're going to talk more with him in just a moment.
Here at home, abortion is a big obstacle facing Senate Democrats today on the road to health care reform. Anti-abortion lawmakers in both parties want restrictions on insurance coverage for abortions. Liberals say that's going too far. The government bailout program looks like it won't be as expensive as first thought. The Treasury Department says that most banks will have repaid their debt, and the effect on the deficit will be only $42 billion instead of $341 billion that was projected. House Democrats want to use some of that money for a new jobs bill. President Obama will meet with the Turkish Prime Minister at the White House today. Turkey now has control of the rotating command of NATO forces in Afghanistan, and the White House is expecting to pressure the Prime Minister to add Turkish troops to the mission. Stocks ended mixed in Asia with the Nikkei up, but the Hang Seng down. Gold is slumping today, and futures are also a bit down. The Dow opens this hour at 10,388. The S&P opens at 1,105, and the NASDAQ opens just under 2,200.
World leaders are meeting in Copenhagen on climate change. It's a different conversation at home, though. So what easy solutions are out there for people to to do, and why aren't they doing them? We're going to talk about that more later. And we're asking you, what decisions have you made because of the environment? Have you gotten those twirly, swirly light bulbs maybe to help a little bit? Did you make these decisions because you'd be saving money or because of the environment? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, more on Copenhagen and what you should be watching for. That's in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Energy efficiency.
More than just getting you to change a light bulb.
Climate change.
Renewable energy.
This is what the U.S. has committed. This is what the EU has committed for 2020.
What can I do about it?
It's called the most important international gathering of the year. Others are calling it the Conference to Save the Planet. It's the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen. It begins today, and we're joined now by someone who is there. James Cantor is the European correspondent for the International Herald Tribune. Hi again, James.
Hello there.
A little noisy there where you are with people milling about behind you.
Indeed, indeed. I'm actually in the area where all the government delegations are. Here is where they plot out what they're going to be negotiating on over the next 2 weeks.
Well, that,
and so people are coming and going.
That must be a tense location, actually, because, you know, the expectations for this conference have gone really far down since when it was initially billed. They have been working on this conference for years and years and years. It was supposed to be the successor to the Kyoto Protocol and get a final worldwide treaty signed to fix the global warming project, but that's not what we're talking about now, is it?
Not quite what we're talking about. What the organizers of the conference are talking about and what they really want to achieve at the end of this 2 weeks is to have a framework so when they go into 2010, they can dot the I's and cross the T's and have something approximating a global treaty if indeed there is the will among nations to tackle greenhouse gases in that fashion. It's not yet clear whether a global treaty will be the tool that's used, but certainly I think most nations, especially the Europeans, as well as nations in the developing world, would like to see some form of agreement globally that would hold nations to account.
James Cantor, we heard India coming to the table talking about cutting their greenhouse gases, and we heard target levels from both the U.S. and from China. Is setting a target one of the big advances that we're seeing coming into this conference?
Yes. I think if you speak to officials from the United Nations Climate Office and from the UN Environment Program, this is a point that they underline. We just had Ivo de Boer, who's the head of the UN Climate Office, say this morning that never in the 17 years of climate change negotiations that he's been involved in has he seen so many nations make so many firm pledges all at more or less the same time. So almost every day, it seems, over the last couple of weeks, countries have been announcing new targets and plans of action, and that certainly has given what's going on here, or what's getting off the ground here this morning, a certain feeling of momentum.
Okay, so James Cantor is at Copenhagen. You can hear all the people milling about behind him. Quite a bit quieter where Ben Smith is. Ben Smith is the senior political reporter for Politico. Good morning, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
President Obama is attending this conference, as are many world leaders, and a lot of people say that that shows a commitment to this climate change issue. And I'm wondering, how much political capital is President Obama risking by appearing at the conference, by setting a target for the United States?
Well, I mean, I think the central question issue is that he chose not to make this a priority. You know, early this year, they decided that healthcare would be the first fight, I think partly because they thought it would be a clean and easy win, and that they would then take the momentum from that and turn to climate change. That's not how it's worked out. And in fact, they've now teed up a sort of populist issue of financial reform next and are hoping to get to climate change in the spring. So, I mean, I don't think he's risking that much political capital. He's chosen to put this not on a back burner, but kind of on a side burner.
But do you think that that climate change will get passed on Capitol Hill eventually, that the U.S. can meet the goals that the President Obama has set?
It's unclear. I think most people think it has a pretty good shot. President Obama has set pretty modest goals. What they had at the Sierra Club told me the other day, goals he thinks that will be met, even if even if Congress does nothing. Goals that can be met through administrative action and state action. So I'm not sure if that's exactly true, but you know, he's not set the most ambitious goals in the world.
James Cantor, at the conference in Copenhagen, this is Todd Zwillick here. The fact that the president, you know, that the president had hoped originally to have a climate bill passed or at least a good deal of a way through the Senate by now, the fact that we don't and we're nowhere near a climate bill in the U.S., is that in part what has led to the lowering of expectations there? Is it really that the United States does not have the momentum that many thought that they would by now?
Yes, I think I understood the question. Certainly the inability of the United States, the limits on the president because of the legislative process in the United States has been something that Europeans, who are one of the great sort of negotiating partners in this game, recognized pretty early on a couple of months ago, and efforts were made well ahead of the Copenhagen conference to not necessarily lower expectations, but to come up with a framework so as much as possible could get done while the conference takes place here, and then to try and seal a deal, as it were, sometime in 2010, in order to give that legislative process in the United States enough time to play out.
Ben Smith of Politico, one of the big arguments there is over how much money will go to developing nations from the developed world in order to help the poorer countries pay for reducing their greenhouse gases and making some of these developments. Will that be easier for President Obama to sell? Will giving money to developing nations be the easier pill for Congress to swallow?
Easier, I would think. Yeah, I think right now the really fierce opposition has focused on the mechanism of cap and trade, the mechanism of how you're going to reduce carbon, which is something that would have a real impact on the American economy. I'm sure there will be people who throw a fit over subsidies for developing nations as well. I mean, it's a tough time for President Obama to do anything that is not about sort of directly connected to creating American jobs. And I think he's probably going to wind up trying to cast this in those terms. But no, I don't think this. I think that's probably the easier lift.
Okay, Ben Smith is a senior political reporter for Politico. Quickly, James Cantor, you're there at Copenhagen. Give me a takeaway. People have said this is the conference to save the planet. What do you think we're going to be calling Copenhagen 3 weeks from now?
Well, it's hard to know. I think that when the world leaders gather here in 10 days from now, we really will see whether they come up with an agreement that they can call the beginnings of a global accord. If they do come up with that, then I think it will probably go down as somewhat historic. If they don't, then it will also go down as a historic failure.
Well, it'll be historic one way or the other. That's James Cantor, correspondent for the International Herald Tribune, joining us and keeping us updated all day from Copenhagen. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
President Obama will meet the Turkish Prime Minister in Washington today. He's expected to ask Turkey for more military assistance in Afghanistan. The president will also be asking the Turks about a recent shift in their foreign policy, which has seen dramatic improvements in relations with neighboring Iran. Also in the Capitol today, the Senate's plans to debate funding abortions in government-subsidized health programs, part of the health care debate. Abortion opponents want a ban, even if it's paid for entirely by customers' premiums. In international news, thousands of opposition protesters have clashed with Iran Iranian security forces and pro-government militiamen outside of Tehran University. On a day of planned student demonstrations, witnesses say militiamen waded into the crowds of protesters, beating them and firing live ammunition. Our partner, the BBC, reports that other demonstrations are going on outside of Tehran.
Staying overseas, the U.S. envoy for North Korea, Stephen Bosworth, has been consulting with the South Korean government before he travels to North Korea for 3 days of talks. His visit to Pyongyang will begin on Tuesday. Bosworth is trying to bring North Korea back into the six-party talks about his nuclear program. North Korea has pushed for direct talks with the United States ever since leaving the negotiations in April. And some space news. Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic Company is unveiling a commercial spacecraft today. Around 300 wealthy individuals have already paid a deposit for a $200,000 trip. The craft is 60 feet long and can carry 6 passengers and 2 pilots. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, Senate Democrats need a pep talk on health care, and the president is there to give it to them. We're asking you all day today, what have you changed to accommodate the environment? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some takeouts now on stories we're following this week. We'll go to Washington first. Jay Newton Small is the congressional correspondent for Time Magazine. President Obama went down to Capitol Hill yesterday. He spoke to members of his party for about 40 minutes about passing health care legislation. Here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid talking about the task at hand.
We're working toward a consensus. We're not there, but we understand how important it is we arrive at a consensus, and we're going to do that just as quickly as we can.
Okay, Jay, the issues they have left are those which may not lead to a consensus. They still have to talk about abortion and the public option. Are we going to get a unified front from the Democrats?
Well, it's looking increasingly like no, not at all. In fact, today's vote on abortion, which is expected this afternoon about 3:15 in the Senate, will probably lose them. Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson, it's his amendment. He is a pro-life Democrat who said that he will not support the bill if it does not pass, and it's looking unlikely to pass.
Okay, there's hundreds of amendments still pending. Are any of the others going to be as contentious as these two?
There are some that are fairly contentious, but no, these are really the two giant big sticking points that are left.
Okay, so here's Harry Reid in the Capitol. He's talking after President Obama met with Democrats yesterday.
There are still a few things we have to work out in the bill, but the issues are being narrowed as we speak.
He's talking about trying to get issues on the health care bill narrowed down, and he talks like it's no big deal, but it's probably a very big deal.
Well, it is a big deal, and certainly when they're trying to get as much support as they can. But frankly, they're going to corral their Democrats. They're going to sit on top of the ones that are leaners, and anyone else who's offering amendments, they're just going to say, sorry, the tree is full, there's no more space for you, and too bad.
Okay, Jay Newton Small. We're obviously going to keep our eye on the health care debate in the Senate all week long. Jay Newton Small is the Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. Thanks.
All right, it's time for our sports takeout with the Takeaway Sports Contributor. Of course, that's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. It's college football on tap, Ibrahim. There was some drama now on Saturday between the Longhorns, Texas Longhorns, and Nebraska Cornhuskers. This, as far as I know, is like the biggest rivalry in college football.
It's pretty big. It's pretty big. But I wouldn't say it's the biggest one, but let's get that.
Third down and 13. Roll pocket right. Throw it out of bounds and stop the clock. Wait a minute. Did the game end? Nebraska thinks it's over. Mack thinks there's a second left. I thought there was a second left.
Woo! All right. Now, that sounds like it qualifies as drama in college football, biggest rivalry or not. What are they talking about there?
Well, basically, you had Nebraska was in position to do the unthinkable, and everyone around the country, from the Boise State fans, the Cincinnati fans, the rest of the – they probably had more people around the country rooting for Nebraska than any other time in the school's history, because if they had beaten Texas, then a bunch of the other teams would have been contention for the national championship. The way the BCS is run, it's based on computer-generated rankings and their people's schedules. So Nebraska – that was a very strange play and made some of the Nebraska fans and myself feel like perhaps there was something larger at play. Perhaps people just wanted to see Alabama versus Texas in the national championship game instead of seeing Nebraska topple Texas and have something else derive out of that. And so that basically led to a 1 second left on the clock and a miraculous field goal, which Texas ended up winning. But that basically in college football, you have two levels. You have the bowl four levels. You have the bowl championship series, and then you have the football championship series, which is also like what used to be called 1AA. So most of these teams, Texas, Boise State, Cincinnati, they're all playing for a bowl game and a chance to be in line for the national title. So now that's what you have coming up this year. You have Alabama versus Texas, Colt McCoy, who's the star quarterback for Texas, against Mark Ingram, who's the running back. They're both Heisman Trophy candidates. That's going to be a huge game. But you also have a huge win with Cincinnati beating Pittsburgh this weekend, 45-44. That puts Cincinnati in a position to be playing Florida now in the consolation game, in a sense, the Sugar Bowl, which is a massive game, in a sense, to see if Florida can bounce back from losing.
Ibrahim, I have covered the Senate for many years, and I thought that was the most arcane thing that you can cover. But apparently the college bowl system is even more arcane and a little bit more difficult.
There's a lot of arguments about it.
Yeah. It is difficult. And then just real quick, this weekend it's going to be Appalachian State versus Montana and William & Mary versus Villanova in the second round. So if you want to see a playoff in college football, which President Barack Obama said in his election run, he wanted to see a playoff in college football.
He did.
Right.
Then you have one in the 1AA level with the football championship series, and that's coming up this weekend
as well.
He
came out and he said he wanted an end to this system. It might make the next college football takeout a little simpler, but
easier
probably
to
more
pass
exciting.
Than healthcare.
All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks for talking to us about college football.
Our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. Last week, the economy got some good signs with better-than-expected unemployment numbers, but that's what economists were watching. What are you seeing in your neck of the woods? Larry in Detroit emails us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. My shop is located along a major east-west rail line. I've noticed a real upswing in rail traffic recently, with many of the trains pulling fully loaded rail cars full of new cars. It's unscientific evidence that things are picking up, I know, but nonetheless, one that I think shows some hope.
All right, so that's some good news for Larry in Detroit. But as we've learned on this show, unemployment lags behind other signs of the recovery. We know that there are millions of you still out of work, so no matter what the numbers say, how is the social safety net out there catching you?
This is Amy in Oklahoma City. I was laid off at the beginning of this year, and I was an independent contractor, and I couldn't get any unemployment. And so I had to use my tax money that I had saved up to live on because I couldn't get unemployment. So now I don't have any more tax money to live on, and I owe the government federal taxes.
My name is Paul. I live in Bronx, New York. I think the problem is people do not save enough money when they are working. Unemployment is, in my opinion, a form of a scam. It's social engineering. The government needs to stop this. People should not be thinking of unemployment as any kind of thing to depend on. They should be thinking on their own earnings and their own savings.
We want to keep hearing your views on employment and jobs and the social safety net. 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We did get one personal take from someone. President Obama was in Allentown, Pennsylvania last week talking about job creation, and Peggy in New Jersey called with her take on Allentown.
Which is my hometown, and I think it really symbolizes what's happened to the American dream in this country. When I grew up, it was a terrific city, and now it's plagued by crime and dissolution of the business community as industries have left. And I think this is where President Obama needs to be.
What about you and your city and the American dream? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we go behind closed doors with President Obama.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, how did the president make his decision on the buildup in Afghanistan? We'll talk with New York Times' Peter Baker for a look inside the president's war council. More on that in just a few minutes. Right now, let's check on the top news stories at 31 minutes past the hour. Iranian security forces are clashing with thousands of protesters right now outside Tehran University. There are reports of police using live ammunition. The police surrounded the university as protesters gathered to show their opposition to the government. Meanwhile, in Copenhagen this morning...
scientific prognoses show that the continent of Africa will be severely hit if we do not act now.
After years of negotiating and debate, 2 weeks of talks aimed at a new deal on climate change have begun. Pledges by the U.S., India, and China to cut emissions have raised hopes a deal will be reached in Copenhagen. But speaking earlier on The Takeaway, International Herald Tribune correspondent James Cantor says delegates do not expect a binding treaty out of this conference.
What the organizers of the conference are talking about and what they really want to achieve at the end of this 2 weeks is to have a framework so when they go into 2010, they can dot the I's and cross the T's.
President Obama will fly to Copenhagen next week for the final days of the summit.
Senator Claire McCaskill says the longstanding policy barring federal funding for abortion is enough. She tells The Early Show a tougher amendment to the Senate health care bill must be defeated.
What this amendment does is goes further. It actually says you can't use private money in a private market for any kind of health services related to abortions. And frankly, I think that goes too far.
The Senate is expected to debate the amendment today. Markets look like they're mostly flat. The Dow, the S&P, NASDAQ, same story. They're all about 1 to 2 points down. So no big movements on the stock market yet. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
The review has allowed me to ask the hard questions and to explore all the different options, along with my national security team, our military and civilian leadership in Afghanistan, and our key partners. And given the stakes involved, I owed the American people and our troops no less.
That was President Barack Obama delivering his new strategy on the war in Afghanistan last week before cadets at West Point and justifying how he came to that decision. Now, new details about how that review was conducted are beginning to come out, and a story from our partners, the New York Times, is in today with White House correspondent Peter Baker. He's written a story that gives extraordinary insight into the workings of the Obama White House and the War Council. It captures the style of some of the president's advisors, how leaked memos and intense debates influenced a three-month-long deliberative process that ultimately shaped the new strategy we heard about just last week. Peter Baker, as I said, is White House correspondent for our partners, the New York Times. He's on the line with us now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Peter, along with some of your colleagues from the Times, I think seven or eight people who contributed to the story, you spent a lot of time researching the process that led to the president announcing a buildup in the Afghanistan strategy. Now, you describe these meetings in the White House Situation Room with coffee cups and Coke cans strewn everywhere, paper spread about the tables, and a president that you describe as, I think, a cross between a professor and a prosecutor. Bring us inside the room there.
Well, that's right. Look, this was probably the most defining decision that this president has made so far in his administration. He took a little time with it. He took 3 months with it because every time they thought, his advisors thought they were getting a little closer, he had more questions. He wanted more information. In the end, the intelligence agencies for the country produced 36 separate reports in response to the questions he asked. The Pentagon and State Department bureaucracies produced thousands of pages of other documents. It was methodical, it was rigorous, it was earnest, it was prolonged, and at times for many of the participants it was deeply frustrating.
Now, you've boiled all these meetings down, these War Council meetings in the Situation Room and memos passing back and forth between Biden and Obama, and boiled all them down to one moment that you think was the decisive turning point for when the president was starting to solidify his strategy and where he was going to go on Afghanistan. What was that turning point?
Well, on November 11th, just about a month ago, Veterans Day, the president came from a visit to Arlington National Cemetery, where he had walked through the white gravestones, the tombstones of soldiers and other servicemen who had lost specifically in Afghanistan and Iraq. He came to a meeting in the afternoon, and they were looking at a plan that would get a surge of troops in, if you will, over 18 months. And they had a bell curve chart showing how troop levels would go up until around July of 2011 and then begin to flatten out and go down. And he says, look, this is just too slow. He says, I want to push this to the left, meaning the bell curve. We have to move them in faster.
To the left means he wants it to start and end sooner.
Get them in faster, get them out faster, exactly. The sooner that we get the reinforcements in, the sooner we can see if it works and turn the security over to the Afghan government itself.
So get them in faster and get them out faster. And what you described is basically the buildup and then the beginning of the withdrawal that the president announced and then the secretaries Gates and Clinton have been justifying on TV ever since then. And knowing what you know about the War Council meetings in the Situation Room, I want to ask you this. The strategy of the buildup definitely satisfied Secretary Clinton, Secretary Gates, and the generals. And the strategy of beginning to pull out satisfied the president's political base, certainly Vice President Joe Biden, and maybe the president's own instincts. So how much of this was this final decision do you think was cohesive military strategy versus a political compromise that so many suspect?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. Obviously, look, this what they would tell you is politics was not the driving force in here, but it would be hard not to be in the back of their minds thinking that you had to convince a very wary Democratic Party, particularly in Congress, if you're going to send more troops, that there was some eventual exit. And that's not just crass politics. I think you have to – there's recognition in Washington that if you don't have public support behind a war, ultimately that's not going to be a successful strategy for anyone. So, you know, I think there was a lot of factors going involved. They will tell you that the decision to have a time frame in which they set July 2011 as the beginning of withdrawal has strategic imperatives that would include putting pressure on the Karzai government in Kabul to step up to fight, to recognize that we're not going to simply prop them up forever, to pressure also even the military and the State Department on our own government to say, look, you know, business as usual isn't going to be good enough.
Right, so we're talking about the competing pressures on the president from the side that wanted the buildup. We're talking about Secretary Gates of Defense, Clinton, and certainly the generals. Then the vice president and perhaps Rahm Emanuel on the other side wanting a drawdown and a much smaller commitment to Afghanistan. You know, it kind of reminded me of the factions and the fights during the Bush administration, Cheney and Rumsfeld, perhaps versus Powell and Condoleezza Rice. But in this case, in your story, Peter, the factions don't seem to be at war with one another, not undercutting each other or insulting each other. Do these people get along better than they did in the Bush administration, or have they just, you know, not had enough time to build up their animosities yet because the administration is young?
Sure. The administration is young, exactly. Look, I mean, by the time of the eighth year of any presidency, particularly one which is as consequential and controversial as Bush's, you're going to have the people who've been fighting it out all these years, you know, increasingly bitter. At this point, this is still a young administration. It's only been a year, but they did have some pretty sharp, you know, debate about this. As you say, Vice President Biden was a very strong skeptic of this, even up to the November 23rd meeting, where the president really has begun, really settled on his plan. Even then, he's raising doubts. He's forcing skepticism about what he sees on the table. You know, are they personally fractious the way things got in the Bush administration? I don't sense that yet. It's very possible they're just good at hiding it. But let's stay tuned.
All right. Peter Baker of The New York Times, you've got to read his story about being inside the Situation Room and inside the War Council with the president. Coming up, if everyone did a few simple things, it could cut greenhouse gas emissions. So why aren't they doing these simple things? We'll talk about why later this hour. And what are you doing differently because of the environment? You can tell us. We want to hear from you at 8778-MYTAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know what steps you've taken around your house, in your car, at work, or with your kids to do your part on CO2 emissions. Copenhagen is in progress. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. We have talked a lot on this show about research dealing with distracted driving, texting, or talking on the phone. And the fact is that research into the subject is fairly consistent. The fact, if you're talking on the phone, whether it be hands-free, certainly if you're texting, the chances of you getting into a car crash and getting injured in a car crash are phenomenally higher. So what's going on? Why can't we get people to use their cell phones less in the car? Adam Bryant, who is a deputy business editor for our partner, The New York Times, kind of has an idea that maybe it's because of the way cell phones were originally marketed. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
This kind of reminds me of the entire history of the tobacco industry to a certain extent, that we had a product that they knew pretty early on, even as early as the 1960s, was a danger, was a hazard, and had to be used in a limited way, and yet it was marketed exactly the opposite way.
So others have made that parallel as well. I mean, I think you could say the cell phone isn't as dangerous as a cigarette, but it can be used dangerously. And really, the impetus of the story was us asking, how did we come to accept, even celebrate, this behavior of talking on our phones in the car when research shows that it's pretty dangerous?
Well, as I said, they knew all the way back in the 1960s, and yet you talk in the article in the New York Times about how it was marketed as a car phone, and people who were around in the 80s remember these ads of busy executives in expensive suits talking on their car phone as they zipped off to the beach with a surfboard on the back, right?
It was a status symbol. It was a productivity tool. And remember, they were hugely expensive when they first started out. So they were marketed to business people as a time saver. It was just a great productivity tool in your car. And the marketing worked. And cell phones have exploded. They got cheaper, smaller, to the point where everybody had one. And so that sort of created the danger. When you've got everybody on the road with a cell phone talking at once, then the risks go up and up and up. And, you know, all it takes is just standing on a sidewalk watching cars go by. Pretty much everybody in their car is on their phone.
Studies show a driver talking on their phone is four times likelier to get into a crash. Being hands-free does not bring that number down, and mobile phones and driving caused 2,600 fatal crashes a year in the United States alone. How come companies are still able to market phones as useful in the vehicle?
Well, the marketing has evolved away from the car phone simply because, you know, point one is the marketing was successful, right? We all have a phone now, so now it's focused much more on applications. But the marketing really early on was sending a very clear message that it not only was it a good productivity tool, but it was also
Adam, I don't mean to disagree with you, but we have my iPhone that has a GPS on it and directions that I'm supposed to have my hand on my phone driving while I'm following my map.
Right. Well, that's this is the new kind of the next wave of concern that so many of these applications have such rich features, and if you're supposed to be staring at your iPhone while you're driving, again, with all this information, that it creates a new danger.
Yeah, well, we'll see whether or not there's going to be a change. Certainly, as you said, not quite as bad as the tobacco industry, but there are some parallels. I think you can draw an interesting article from Adam Bryant, deputy business editor for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Today I'm here with Celeste Headley. Coming up, how do you change people's behavior so they'll take the right steps in cutting greenhouse gases? We'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The swine flu vaccine shortage will get better this week. New public service announcements are out today about the swine flu vaccine. Another 10 million doses are expected to be available. In international news, a special U.S. envoy is about to head to North Korea to try to talk to the North into coming back into Six Nations nuclear talks. Envoy Stephen Bosworth is in Seoul today to talk to officials about his trip. International talks stalled about a year ago.
The United Nations' largest global climate conference has started in Copenhagen. Representatives from almost 200 countries will meet for 2 weeks, trying to work out an agreement on how to manage climate change. And today is Students' Day in Iran. Planned anti-government protests in the capital, Tehran, have turned violent, according to witnesses. The BBC's John Lyon was thrown out of Iran during its last election, so he reports today from neighboring Turkey.
Large numbers of police and members of the government's besieged militia have been trying to prevent students breaking out from their university campuses. It sounds like the confrontation has become increasingly violent. There are reports of student demonstrations not just in Tehran, but at universities across Iran. Students are bitter about President Ahmadinejad's disputed re-election and about attempts to impose tighter controls on students, universities, and what they're allowed to study. They've been chanting slogans against President Ahmadinejad and also against the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, himself.
The BBC's Iran correspondent, John Lyon. That's a wrap-up of some of the big stories we're following this morning.
And it's hard rains are gonna fall.
Bob Dylan there. You don't need any help with that. The United Nations has adopted one of his songs, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, as its unofficial anthem for the talks. But a lot of us seem to need help on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. You know, as the climate talks take off in Copenhagen, 192 countries there, cutting emissions from trucks and utilities and big factories is one thing, but it really is all about each of us in our homes and in our cars and how to cut emissions ourselves if the planet Earth is going to get anywhere with greenhouse gas emissions. So in short, why don't we do in our own lives what we know would help when it comes to the environment? Well, we have two guests here with us who have a good idea why, both of whom I think are headed to Copenhagen later this week. David Biello is associate online editor of Scientific American. He follows climate change very closely. And Ben Ho is a behavioral economist at Cornell University. Now, both of these gentlemen, as I said, think they have some insight into our behavior and why we don't
do the right thing.
Put our money where our mouth is or put our money where the air is, Celeste,
when
it comes to the environment. David, you have outlined 33 simple actions that we can take in our own homes, in our own cars, I would assume, to help ease the stress on the environment that we all know would work, but that we don't do them. What are some of these and what's the problem?
Well, let me start by setting up the problem. Our homes are responsible for about 40% of U.S. emissions. That's almost half, obviously.
All right, so that means that we have a lever to do something about this
ourselves.
We have
a big lever.
Right.
And by taking some of those 33 steps, we could cut U.S. emissions by about 7%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but that's equal to the amount of emissions that come from petroleum refineries, aluminum smelters, and iron and steel works. So these are some pretty big combined, exactly. So these are some pretty big emitters. Those actions include weatherizing your home. It doesn't sound very sexy, but adding a lot of more insulation will cut down on your energy bills. Power strips, again, not very sexy, but plugging in all your devices into power strips. Instead of into the wall directly will cut down on your standby electricity use. Standby electricity use is responsible for about 200 plus pounds of carbon emissions from every American household every year.
Now, you're certain that these things will cut my costs, because you're saying this to me and I say, that's great, I'd love to do them, but I don't have the cash right now to run out and buy extra insulation at Home Depot. I have power strips, but I don't want to go out and buy another dozen of them, but it will lower my costs, we're sure of
that? It will ultimately lower your costs. Now, that's one of the barriers, right, that we're talking about, why people don't do these things. And it's because of flaws in designs of programs. So, for example, the federal government has a program to help you weatherize your house. Did you know that?
You just told me.
Yeah. I don't think too many people are aware of this program.
Right.
And it's because it's not well advertised. It's a lot of money. It's billions of dollars. And they're trying to help you put more insulation in your home. It's poorly designed because it's a tax credit. So you're going to have to spend a bunch of money up front, and then you're going to maybe get some of your money back at the end of the year when you file your taxes, if you remember to take the appropriate credit.
And file the papers. Ben Ho, you're a behavioralist at Cornell University. Is what David's describing here, is this a problem of a proximal action and then benefit way down the line? Is that why people don't do these things? Or is it more that the environment is such a distant sort of force, it's not in their home, or at least they don't think that it is, that people don't want to do anything about it directly?
I think both problems are at play right here. One is, you know, like you said, it's a very distant benefit that we're thinking about. One is that what economists normally call the public goods problem, which is that when people share a resource in common and there's many people individually responsible for taking care of that resource, it's easy for us to sort of stand by and let somebody else do it. You know, psychologists call this the bystander effect. But the other issue is that even for things that help ourselves individually, things that will lower our electricity bill, people have a tendency to procrastinate, and research has shown that people are most likely to procrastinate when, you know, the costs are immediate and concrete, but the benefits are sort of abstract and in the future. And because benefits to in terms of electricity savings are sort of this abstract thing, and benefits to the environment are this abstract thing that happens far in the future, we just don't take action today.
Ben Ho, you are a behavioral economist at Cornell University. This kind of thing that you're talking about is something that we in public radio deal with all the time.
Yes.
I mean, it is true that because there's a ton of people that listen to public radio, it's very difficult to get people to step up to the plate and donate. But the thing is, they do.
Right.
They do it. So
right.
You can get people to make these steps.
Yeah, and part of my own research is how do we get people to donate more, right? And so one mechanism we looked at is basically, what if we make people feel more responsible, more personally responsible for their impact on the environment? And so one thing we do is we basically, we recruited 600 subjects, and we basically found out information about their driving habits, their commuting habits, their electricity use. And for some of them, that's all we told them, and we found out how much are they willing to do for the environment, and the answer is not much. Right. Then we told some of them, you know, this is your carbon footprint. This is how much you're personally responsible for hurting the environment. Now, what are you willing to do? And the answer is still not much. But the crucial thing is we basically then told another group, you know, this is how much damage you're doing to the environment, but this is how much, you know, you're doing compared to somebody else.
And you're worse than somebody else, and nobody wants to be worse than somebody else.
Exactly. And
that's
there
interesting.
It shot up. Right. Basically,
that's interesting.
People went to pay 30% more to sort of fight climate change.
It's also about making things easier. So you look at the Cash for Clunkers program, a huge success. The reason that's a success, even though it has many similarities to the weatherization program that nobody knows about, is that the paperwork was all handled by the dealerships. You basically show up
with your old car.
With your old car.
You drive
get
away
your
with
new,
a new one.
Yeah. So making things easier is also a huge barrier.
Now, David Biello from Scientific American, what about making things a little bit sexier? I mean, is there an element of this of making people want to do these things? You know, 5 years ago, the Hummer and the Escalade was the sexiest thing on the road. Now they're really out of style. And these smart cars, which look like golf balls, are cool all of a sudden. And whoever would have thought, now that's clever marketing from people who want to make money, but it shows that things that used to be geeky or not cool, you can make people want them.
Right. It's all about status. What's going to show the right status to your neighbors? This is what Ben was just talking about. Is it the Prius in your driveway, or is it the Hummer in your driveway? And what you really want, or what we want for the climate is a more energy efficient car.
All right, David Biello, associate online editor at Scientific American, and Ben Ho, he's a behavioralist and economist at Cornell, helping us make sense of how to make changes in our homes for the environment. So I think it's time we bring this story back to our listeners. What are some easy solutions that you and your family are taking care of? What is too hard for you to do?
My name is Patty from Linfield, and I hang out clothes to dry outside and inside the house in the wintertime. It adds moisture to the air, and I bought a high-mileage car and do turn lights off and things like that.
Hi, this is Phil Keller from Long Island, New York. I have actively recycled plastic bags and plastics of all kind. In addition, I drive a hybrid car. Unfortunately, I have a long commute and pay money to monthly support energy with wind.
Because Betty emails us to say, because the Maldives is rumored to be underwater in a decade or so, I went on vacation there. It was worth the money, by the way, she said. Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillick, and for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. John will be back tomorrow to tell us all about his new baby boy, Ajax. But before he does, here's one takeaway.
Leon Freilich in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Boom, 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 boom. He's Ajax, the bouncing baby. Boom, 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 boom. May he grow up smart and strong. Boom, 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 boom.
That's your takeaway. This is Celeste Headley, and this is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.